Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our analysts this hour, Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, and Jonathan Hasid, associate professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jonathan and Donna, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
And
great
Jonathan.
To be here, Ben.
Great to hear both of your voices later in the hour. I wanted to discuss the congressional debate over more pandemic stimulus, the debate over the Senate filibuster, what a filibuster is, how that's evolved, and also toward the end of the hour, the coming impeachment trial of former President Trump for incitement of insurrection scheduled to start the week after next. We want to invite our listeners to join us during this hour on any of the topics we're talking about. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Hard to believe, just a week of the Biden presidency behind us, and so much has happened. Let's talk about what topped this hour's news from NPR. President Biden expected this afternoon to speak about climate, job creation, scientific integrity, announcing that he will elevate climate change at every level of the federal government. It will also include a pause on fossil fuel leasing. Let's talk about this for a few minutes. Donna, there's been an evolution in terms of public attitudes toward climate change and what should be done. How do you see that affecting Biden's agenda here, putting this so prominent in his priorities?
Well, I think that topic was important for him building his electoral coalition. It was something he talked about during the campaign. I noticed this morning just in the Des Moines Register, there was a study out of Iowa State that cited 81% of Iowans believe in climate change, effects of climate. And so as, the evidence has accumulated, this used to be a bipartisan issue, and then it became kind of a partisan issue. But there have been multiple big studies and more attention given to this issue throughout the last 10 years, especially, that, it is part of his platform and part of now his presidency that he's going to approach that. Biden has talked about in the campaign as president-elect and also in his inaugural address about the four big things, and then in the inaugural address became five big things that his administration needed to tackle. COVID, racial justice, the economy, and climate change was the fourth one. The fifth one that got added in was the rise of extremism. And so this has long been something that we have seen Biden talk about. And we knew early on, also, for example, he was going to appoint former Secretary of State Kerry as kind of the envoy here in terms of this issue as well. So this is obviously a priority for his administration.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I did see that ISU poll, more than 80% of Iowa farmers say climate change is occurring, Donna. But also another part of that poll, despite this, only 18% of Iowa farmers say humans are mostly responsible for causing the planet to warm, according to that poll, when science clearly shows human activity is driving the climate change. Jonathan, I want to play a little clip from, I guess this is last week, and have you react to this, because it really kind of pinpoints the narratives that I think we're hearing and have been hearing on climate change. During last week's Senate confirmation hearing for Transportation Secretary nominee Pete Buttigieg, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas criticized Biden's decision to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline permit. Let's listen to this.
I will say it was disconcerting to see yesterday, the first day of the Biden administration, straight out of the gate, President Biden announced that he was canceling the Keystone pipeline. That is a major infrastructure project. That is a project that right now today has 1,200 good-paying union jobs. And in 2021, the Keystone pipeline was scheduled to have more than 11,000 jobs, including 8,000 union jobs, for contracts worth $1.6 billion. And with the stroke of a pen, President Biden has told those 11,000 workers, those union workers, your jobs are gone. Mr. Buttigieg, what do you say to those workers whose jobs have just been eliminated by presidential edict?
Well, I think the most important thing is to make sure that we make good on the promise of the president's climate vision as being one that, on net, creates far more jobs, millions, we hope. I know that won't just happen. We'll have to do a lot of work to make sure that's real. But getting this right means ensuring that there are more good-paying union jobs for all Americans delivered through that infrastructure vision.
So for those workers, the answer is somebody else will get a job?
The answer is that we are very eager to see those workers continue to be employed in good-paying union jobs, even if they might be different ones.
Jonathan Haseeb, react to that testimony from the Transportation Secretary nominee Pete Buttigieg and Senator Ted Cruz.
Yeah, I mean, the Keystone Pipeline, of course, has been controversial for a long time. It's been a political football for a long time, dating back to, you know, before the Obama term in office. And it also has international ramifications, of course, because ultimately it was designed to get oil from Canada. It's a Canadian pipeline that would bring oil from the Alberta tar sands into the United States for processing. And so, as we heard from Pete Buttigieg, right, the Biden camp has to weigh these competing concerns. Of course, union members are a part of Biden's base, although they've been drifting away from the Democratic Party in the last few cycles. But I think the Biden administration made the calculation that, constituencies who are interested in the environmental effects of, and the climate change issue are ultimately more important than, you know, the few thousand union direct union jobs that would be lost by canceling this pipeline. Mm-hmm. I would also like to point out that, you know, the pipeline cancellation is one of the, you know, Biden, of course, isn't a king, right? He can't, there's only so much he can do. And so canceling the pipeline is one of the things he can do by executive order without going through Congress. And given how deadlocked Congress looks likely to be, I expect that we're going to see lots of these kind of, not necessarily symbolic, but not necessarily hugely impactful executive orders, because, you know, Biden's going to have a hard time getting climate legislation through, especially through the Senate.
Mm-hmm. It's a good time to remind our listeners, if you're more interested in the scientific environmental health aspects of this, yesterday we had Peter Thorne on, former chair of the EPA's scientific advisory board, talking about this very aspect and pointing out that in terms of Iowa jobs, we have a lot in the meantime invested in wind and solar energy, a lot of jobs there. Just referring back to that conversation we had with we heard a bit of from Buttigieg and Senator Cruz. To finish this off, Donna, perhaps you could tell us what will we need to see happen in to have any movement towards meaningful legislation for Congress to act so that we don't have simply presidential executive orders doing what they can.
Well, we're at a time where it's taken several weeks for the Senate to even get an agreement on their organizing resolution. So Congress is frequently slow, and it's not even meant to work quickly. But the margins in Congress are very, very small. The American populace seems to be very, very divided. We know that negative partisanship increasingly has had a role to play here, where it's not just partisanship. We've always had that. It is the fact that if you're of a different partisan persuasion than I am, I really don't like you. And that is really corrosive here. And we can see it even in the rhetoric of Congress, where oftentimes statements that are put out by members of Congress, Republican members may talk about Democrats' socialist agenda, right? They use that inflammatory rhetoric to try to gin this up. But the country doesn't move forward if there isn't some agreement on certain things. There will not be agreement on everything. And so this is the task of governing in this age, whether you're president or whether you're a leader in Congress, is trying to get as much as you can done. And that is particularly difficult in this environment, and especially when it comes to energy, climate change, those tend to be particularly divisive and partisan.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, our two political analysts looking at the first week of the Biden presidency actions there. Also in the latest number of executive orders from the president, let's talk about what the president calls a call to heal America's racial divide. He's taking several steps, promising to confront racism, inequality that he says has plagued the U.S. for far too long. He took executive action yesterday, I believe, on four fronts: curbing the U.S. government's use of private prisons, bolstering anti-discrimination enforcement in housing, underscoring a commitment to Native American tribal sovereignty, and also condemning some discrimination against Asian Americans and Americans of Pacific Island descent that he said has risen during this COVID-19 pandemic. Let's listen to a little bit of, from the White House domestic policy advisor, Susan Rice, on this. She addressed these actions yesterday in a conversation with Judy Woodruff on the PBS NewsHour.
We don't just invest in equity and racial justice out of moral purpose, as significant as that may be. We do it because it benefits every single American, not just one group or another. You know, there have been important studies that have been recently conducted by economists, including at Citi, which have indicated that if we can close the racial gap in income and opportunity, all Americans stand to benefit. We will add $5 trillion to the economy over 5 years and create 6 million new jobs for everybody. So this work is the business of making all Americans do better.
Okay, Jonathan, take the lead here in explaining here what's behind the executive actions on this front.
Sure. I mean, the executive actions are the result, of course, of persistent racial inequities in America. You know, especially in income, but also wealth. So if you look at the average wealth of a white family in America versus a black family, the black family on average has much lower family wealth, even if they make similar income. And of course, you know, some of this is the result of, you know, the American historical trauma that, you know, black Americans and others have lived through. And so the Biden camp is trying to use the relatively limited levers that it has to try to attack this problem. Once again, these are executive orders. You know, some of them are symbolic, symbolism is important, but it doesn't get you all the way there. You know, things like enforcing anti-discrimination in federal housing is important because many millions of people live in federal housing, but of course, it's still only a small percentage of the U.S. housing stock. And so without Congress, you know, I mean, we haven't really had major landmark civil rights legislation, arguably since 1964-65, the Civil Rights Act. So it's been a long time since Congress has acted really in a systematic way on this. And I, you know, it's not likely to happen in 2021 either. And so Biden is, you know, signaling to his base that he's interested in these issues, he's committed to these issues. But of course, there's only so much he can do with the stroke of a pen without Congress.
We should note here, black voters proving essential to Biden, not only in defeating Trump in the November 3rd election, but also in the primary, a little further into the primary season, past the Iowa caucuses, is when that really made its presence felt. Donna, you know, to Jonathan's point there about, you know, Congress's division, there are two narratives going here. Here's a quote from Rand Paul reacting on this theme to President Biden's inaugural address. He said, quote, "If you read his speech and listen to it carefully, much of it is thinly veiled innuendo calling us white supremacists, calling us racists, calling us every name in the book." So a bipartisan consensus on this issue there is not, Donna, or else.
There is not, obviously. It was interesting that despite the fact that Biden didn't, in fact, call his opponents racist, that was some of the characterization that was picked up by not just Paul, a few others did that as well. And this call to unity has been echoing, especially in the wake of what is going to happen, particularly in the Senate with former President Trump's impeachment trial. How much unity do you do with, you know, insurrectionists? Maybe one of the questions that the Senate will need to reckon with in the future. And so Biden's speech from last week really was this call for unity, but also this call for kind of recognizing that we still have a long way to go in terms of these big themes that I mentioned earlier that Biden has chosen to target, the inequities in terms of even who is getting COVID and who is dying from COVID, the income and wealth disparities that Jonathan mentioned. These are things that historically have been with us. We know that redlining from the 1930s still impacts things like wealth accumulation of certain neighborhoods even now, even impacts things like the temperatures people have to endure in cities in the summer. This is what we talk about when we talk about structural racism in the United States. And it is the work of hundreds of years in this country, and it will take a very long time to break that down. What helps with that is Americans coming to the realization that these are still problems that are with us. They're not problems of a past age. They are still problems that are with us and still have effect. And that is one of the big challenges of any administration right now, but Biden's in particular, given the division that we have right now and how that developed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the impeachment trial. Let's dive into that here before this half hour ends. Yesterday, U.S. senators sworn in as jurors to preside over the impeachment of former President Donald Trump. The former president charged with one article of impeachment in this second time for incitement of insurrection at the Capitol 3 weeks ago. Yesterday, only five members of the Republican Party joined Democrats in a vote to go forward with this impeachment trial. The vote was 55-45. The Senate narrowly killing this Republican effort to dismiss the proceeding as unconstitutional because Donald Trump is no longer in office. The only Republicans who joined Democrats in voting to reject the constitutional objection and proceed were the Republicans, Senators Collins, Murkowski, Romney, Sass from our neighbor here, Nebraska, Toomey, notable, neither Ernst nor Grassley joined with the Democrats on this. Let's get Mike here calling from out of state. Mike, you wanted to weigh in on this issue. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yeah, my question, and you actually just touched on it, I had not heard what was put forth by Republicans yesterday, but that's kind of why I called in. Maybe my question is more one of semantics. How can you impeach a person that's no longer president? So I wanted to ask, you know, is impeachment strictly for a president in office, or is it a little bit of semantics and it actually becomes a different procedure? And then related, but I understand it's separate, how the legislature might vote to not allow Trump to run for office. Mm-hmm. I understand that would not be impeachment, but they could issue some type of ruling. So can you just comment on those issues relative to how they are framed in the Constitution? And I'll hang up my phone and take the answers back on the radio.
Okay, Mike, thank you so much for your call. Mike on the road there from Wisconsin, I see on my screen, driving through Iowa. Nice to have you as a listener to Iowa Public Radio. Jonathan, tackle those two questions. A president out of office being impeached, and does impeachment then block him from holding office in the future?
Yeah, great questions from Mike. So, you know, it's not super clear if someone can be impeached out of office, but there is historical precedent for it in the United States. In 1876, Secretary of War William Belknap was impeached in the House for embezzlement, sort of comical levels of corruption in the Grant administration. He resigned moments before the impeachment was conducted to the Senate, where he certainly would have been convicted. The Senate then debated for a few weeks and agreed to have a trial, an impeachment and conviction trial for Belknap anyway. He was ultimately not convicted. He was acquitted. And he went out to live the rest of his life as a public citizen. But there is precedent in the United States, and a majority of senators in 1876 agreed that former officials can be convicted. In this case, Donald Trump, as the vote signaled yesterday, Donald Trump will not be convicted by the U.S. Senate. There simply aren't the votes to do it. And so the second part of that bar, the disqualification from office, is not likely to happen. The way most legal scholars read it is that the House impeaches somebody. It then goes to the Senate. The Senate, of course, has to have a two-thirds vote to convict. After the two-thirds have voted to convict, which, again, will not happen here, the Senate, by a simple majority vote, can then bar someone from ever serving in federal office again. So that's a simple majority vote. But most legal scholars think it has to happen after a vote to convict. In other words, you can't just impeach in the House, not convict someone in the Senate, but still, just by simple majority vote, disqualify them from further office. Although, you know, this is sort of an open constitutional question. So No one is entirely clear.
Mm-hmm. Donna, I wonder if you accept what Jonathan said, that the conviction is unlikely. What is then the value of proceeding, the Democrats proceeding with a trial, if this conviction now looks, as of the vote yesterday, unlikely? Because we would need to have, 17 Republicans cross party lines to support the Democrats in finding Donald Trump guilty.
Well, I would think that... you know, one of the things we want to not do here, and especially that the senators want to not do, at least in theory, this may be, you know, a little bit pie in the sky, but not prejudge this. The House managers have not presented their case. It's been reported that they, in particular, are focusing a lot on video evidence of the Trump speech, how it was reacted to in the crowd. And let's not forget that the senators themselves that are sitting in judgment here, and they have to sit there and they have to be quiet through this trial that will take place, they themselves were threatened by this mob. This mob was coming for them. This mob was coming for Mike Pence. We know that. This mob was not just coming for Democratic senators and Democratic representatives. They were coming for anybody in Congress. That was the point of storming the Capitol, to prevent the counting of the Electoral College vote. So that is the purpose of a trial, right? We should not prejudge it. We should say, show us the evidence, and then senators will vote accordingly. And in fact, they may vote with their partisanship. That's highly likely, but that has to take place first. The other thing to point out here is that you know, there needs to be accountability. There needs to be respect for separation of powers. Another way to look at this, that as an institutionalist, somebody who studies the institution of American government, that is particularly troubling here, is that, you know, the executive here under the Articles of Impeachment were incitement of insurrection. Trump sent the mob in to the Capitol to stop that effort in Congress, a separate branch of government.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll continue with Donna Hoffman and Jonathan Haseed, our political analysts, continue to talk about the impeachment trial due to start the week after next. Join our conversation as we discuss the trial and other aspects of our politics currently. 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back with Donna and Jonathan in just a moment. It's River to River.
Iowa Republican leaders encourage wearing a mask at the Capitol, but oppose making it a mandate.
We have no way to enforce that, even if we were to say everyone in the caucus has to have a mask.
This worries Democratic leaders.
I'm concerned and want to avoid, you know, turning the legislature into a super spreader event.
Legislative leaders share their goals and concerns, and so does the governor on the podcast Under the Golden Dome. Listen to the new episode now at iowapublicradio.org.
We're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, two political science professors, our analysts for this week's edition of Politics Wednesday. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Before the break, we were talking about the coming impeachment trial due to start the week after next. Donna there describing a little bit what the senators are facing. They were sworn in as jurors yesterday to preside over this impeachment of Donald Trump. And as we noted in the first half hour, by a vote of 55 to 45, the Senate narrowly killed a Republican effort to dismiss the proceeding as unconstitutional because Donald Trump is no longer in office. There were Five Republicans who joined Democrats in voting to reject this constitutional objection. Neither of those were Ernst or Grassley, our two U.S. Senators. Neither of them joined the Democrats in killing this, what eventually turned into killing this effort to dismiss the proceeding. Let's listen to the words of Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst. She says she will most likely vote against impeaching former President Donald Trump, citing concerns that the impeachment could create a dangerous standard.
He should have been out much sooner telling the crowd, you know, don't, we're peacefully protesting, you know, don't do these actions. He didn't do that soon enough, but does that mean he is guilty of inciting insurrection?
Okay. Jonathan, take this. So what do you think of the Senator Ernst's rationale there?
It seems a little silly to me, given the context of what President Trump had done in the months prior to and up to November 6th. You know, even before Trump lost the election, he was out there announcing that the election was fraudulent. The only way he could lose is that if it were fraud committed, which, of course, we know is not the case. He lost fair and square. He couldn't accept it as a sitting president. He couldn't accept his electoral loss. He tried to arm twist state legislators. He tried to arm twist Congress. He tried the court system. They all failed. And ultimately, he called a mob to the Capitol on January 6th in what can only be described, I think, I mean, other political scientists agree. But for me, this is a clear example of an attempted self-coup, an attempted auto hope, which is to say a sitting executive refuses to accept his electoral loss, tries to illegally remain in power. There should be consequences for this. Or as Donna Hoffman pointed out, you know, we're in serious trouble when the executive branch can unleash violence on Congress in an effort to illegally stay in power without consequences. That's a serious place for the country to be in.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers. We have a number of callers who want to talk about this. Elizabeth calling from Urbandale. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air. Welcome to our program. What's the point you'd like to make or question?
Well, the question has to do with whether or not it is possible for the senators to vote in secret for this impeachment. It seems to me that the Republicans are so, is the phrase, in the thrall of the former president, that they are in lockstep. If they could vote in secret, perhaps 17 actually would cross over. And that's my question. Thank you.
Interesting. Elizabeth, thank you very much for that question. Donna, yeah, we're getting at the motivation that Republicans have to stand by a former president, despite his role in stirring up the mob that violently targeted, as you pointed out, lawmakers, Congress, the vice president on January 6th.
So this was something that came up previously as well in the previous impeachment trial of Donald Trump. Those votes have typically been taken publicly and recorded. I think technically that they could, but that has not been standard practice on that. But, you know, one of the things to understand about the, and part of the reason we're having some of these debates that we're having right now, is that we don't do this very often. And the constitutional language here is quite vague in some ways. But one of the things to consider in terms of impeachment in particular is that impeachment is one of those rare things in the Constitution that doesn't have cross-branch checks. It is a cross-branch check, and it is the sole power of the Senate to do this. It is the sole power of the House to impeach, the sole power of the Senate to try. And so that means that the methods by which they do this are really up to them. And a court typically, we have case history on this, and a court typically will not second-guess this because it is solely up to the Senate in terms of how they proceed on that.
Mm-hmm. Donna, but when we call them jurors, and they were sworn in as jurors, we have to understand that in a completely different way than we would a jury in some kind of trial elsewhere in our country. These are senators whose political careers hang in the balance depending on how they vote.
Well, yes and no. In terms of your you know notion of this isn't like a trial, in some ways it is, and in many ways it is not, as you point out. But one other thing to add into that mix there is that also impeachment is a political process, and it is not a legal process in the sense. So you can impeach somebody for something that may not have been illegal, even high crimes and misdemeanors. What exactly is that? But would be would satisfy in terms of impeachment and conviction, and so it's a political process, and that brings in then considerations of what do my constituents want, how might this affect a future election or re-election campaign, et cetera. And now we even see it's not just, you know, considerations of my constituents now in these decisions that lawmakers are having to make. We know that private businesses have said of those, you know, almost 200 House members that voted not to count the votes, the valid electoral votes, many businesses have come out and said, if you were one of those numbers, we're not going to give money to you. So there are a lot of ramifications here that members of Congress, House members and senators in this situation have to take into account. And it is a very difficult decision. But at the end of the day, they are public servants. They shouldn't be doing what is best for them and their political career. They should be doing what is best for the United States.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. Tom is with us from Shoeyville. Welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting, Tom. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'd like to, if it kind of fits in with the notion of what standard practice that our expert just mentioned. I'm just really baffled and probably even disgusted by the fact that, and impeachment is by no means the only situation where this comes up, that every time a particular situation comes up, it seems like, well, there's no rules here, and so you have a meta discussion before you actually address the situation about, well, what process are we going to follow this time? And I think, to me, that's one of the things that really disgusts me as a citizen to watch, is that these people write laws, and yet they reformulate their rules on the fly day to day. I'll take the answer or commentary offline. Thanks.
Tom in Shoeyville, thank you. Jonathan, what do you have to say about Tom's comment there?
Yeah, I mean, it's true that in a certain sense, you know, government used to be, I mean, I don't want to say that there was a golden age of the American federal government, but it does seem that ethics are getting more situational. That, you know, the filibuster, for example, which I know we'll talk about later, used to be, up until the 1970s, was deployed quite rarely. It was hardly ever used. And then, of course, it started being used more and more. And so essentially, you know, and there's one thing we saw, of course, from the Donald Trump presidency, is that there are lots of things in the American political experience that are norms, not laws. And so if someone wants to violate those norms and there aren't consequences for it, they'll continue to do that. And there's not much that anybody else can do about it. But in terms of, you know, rules about impeachment, debating about how this done, as I said, isn't new. In the 1876 trial of William Belknap, the Senate spent several weeks debating whether or not they could have a trial for a former official, for a now private citizen. Ultimately, they decided that they did, but it took them a long time to decide this. And so this is, you know, coming up with rules for impeachments, for rare impeachments and trials, isn't something that's limited to 2021. This is something that Congress has been struggling with for a long time.
Jonathan Haseeb, Donna Hoffman, our political scientists on this edition of River to River, our Politics Wednesday edition. Let's. I want to wrap up a couple of an email and another caller's question here. Throw these to Donna. A question from Sharon. She asks, if Trump is not impeached, well, he has been impeached a second time. It's whether he will be convicted. She asks, can he be arrested as a private citizen? Also, a caller asks, if the Senate does not pursue charges, I assume this caller means convict. Doesn't that open the possibility of criminal charges like treason and sedition? Asks the caller, Dennis.
Yes. So, you know, again, impeachment is a political process. It's not a criminal process. And so if Trump, and you're correct, right, Trump is the only president to have twice been impeached. An impeachment is like an indictment. It's the trial in the Senate where they would convict or acquit, and then maybe take the punishment under conviction to disqualification from future office. If Trump is not convicted on this count, as he was not on the two previous last year, then this is done for all practical purposes. But that we know there are numerous criminal charges that could potentially be brought against Trump's action, even unrelated to his conduct as president. We know that his business practices are under investigation in New York. We know there are several pending cases related to, there's at least one pending case related to defamation and a sexual assault case. Those cases will go forward. This has no effect on that. As to whether, you know, Trump could be brought up on criminal charges related to sedition or something like that, that is certainly possible, but is highly unlikely given kind of the way that this is playing out. So there are lots and lots of strands here in terms of Trump's criminal liability for actions outside of his conduct as president here, and mostly of them relating to his business practices before. And those things will be unaffected by whatever happens in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. I feel before our hour ends, we need to talk about some other political news, major political news about the filibuster. This week, Senator Mitch McConnell, now the minority leader in the Senate, relented on his demand that the Democrats promise to preserve the filibuster. This ended a several-day impasse. Jonathan, catch us up to speed on what a filibuster is, and why there has been a big fight over it now.
Sure. So what the filibuster says is that basically senators can simply by filibustering, which historically meant talking a lot, but doesn't necessarily have to mean that today, can prevent a bill from going to a vote. And the way you – so, you know, a debate can extend indefinitely. Unlike in the House, where debate is time limited, in the Senate – for many issues, debate can just go on indefinitely until 60, you know, three-fifths of the Senate, which is 60 senators, vote on something called a motion of cloture. Once that passes, then whatever is being filibustered will then go up to an up or down vote. And so what it amounts to is a 60-vote requirement for most major legislation to get through the U.S. Senate. And so the filibuster isn't new. It's existed since the early 19th century, but it was really rarely used, as I said before, up until the 1970s. Since then, it's gotten more and more and more used, such that today, to pass any major legislation that isn't budget-related, essentially you have to have 60 votes in the Senate, because any kind of major legislation is going to be filibustered now. And so what happened was, so of course the Democrats now barely have a Senate majority with Kamala Harris's vice presidential tie-breaking vote. The Democrats have 51, and the Republicans have 50 senators. And up until a couple of days ago, basically, Mitch McConnell, who's now minority leader, was gumming up the works and refusing to essentially allow Senate business to continue until it was decided what the Democrats were going to do with the filibuster. And ultimately, we had a couple of Democrats, in particular Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, come out and basically say, under no circumstances will they get rid of the filibuster. Mm-hmm. And so then after that, McConnell dropped his objections, and now Senate business is proceeding as usual. But, you know, what it means is that the Democrats, who only have 51 seats with Kamala Harris's votes, are going to need, you know, not to find nine more Republican senators for major legislation that isn't budget related. If it's budget related, they can do something called reconciliation and pass it under simple majority, which is how the Affordable Care Act was passed, but it doesn't work for things that aren't budget related.
Right, and also being considered for the next stimulus, if that happens, economic stimulus related to the pandemic. Donna, to this point on the filibuster, can you make a case that the Democrats should get rid of the filibuster in the Senate? Has it benefited in recent decades the political right or left more?
Well, it benefits a minority. It allows a minority to block, and sometimes that minority is Democrats, and sometimes it is Republicans. The question here really is, you know, do you want to have Do you want to slow things down, gum up the works? This has historically been what the Senate is kind of thought of. I mean, even going back to George Washington, he described the Senate as the cooling saucer to Thomas Jefferson. It would take the, it would slow things down. It would cool things off from the reactionary House. It is increasingly difficult for the federal government to function in this environment that we exist in. And this has been chipped away, we should note. We have not talked about how originally this was brought up by Republicans in 2005 to ease the path for George W. Bush's judicial nominees that were being filibustered. That was settled by the Gang of 14, as it was called, seven Republicans, seven Democrats. They put that off. Then in 2013, the Democrats nuked it, as we call it, because of the way that you do it. It only takes a 51 vote to uphold the ruling of the chair on this rather than a rule change. The Democrats did it in 2013 to help ease Obama's appointments, both judicial and in the executive branch, that were being gummed up. And then McConnell did it in 2017 for Supreme Court justices. So the filibuster used to be applied on appointments. It is no longer applied there. Now the only thing at issue here is the legislative filibuster. And it is increasingly in the Democrats' interest here to talk about getting rid of it so that they can move an agenda in a evenly divided Senate. And we should note here that Kamala Harris, you know, will only vote. She's not a regular vote. She will only vote in case of a tie. And that is why, you know, Jonathan mentioned Manchin and Sinema in particular. The Democrats have to hold that caucus together, those 50 senators, for Kamala Harris to be in a position to even be able to cast that vote, because she doesn't regularly cast it, only in case of a tie.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the final 3 or 4 minutes of our program, I'd like to get your reflections on, well, the momentous events of the past weeks. It's been 3 weeks since the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. This week, the Capitol Police apologized for failing to prevent that Capitol riot. They acknowledged that the agency had known that there was, in their words, strong potential for violence and was slow to act. Jonathan, with 3 weeks hindsight on that shocking event, your thoughts about, well, I guess, how our attitudes have changed because of it or not?
You know, at first I was encouraged because, of course, there were a lot of Republican senators who rightly were outraged by what happened, by the conduct of the president and the conduct of this mob, this would-be insurrection. You know, a lot of Republican senators and other Republican officials have since walked back their condemnation a little bit. So Nikki Haley, who, of course, was Trump's UN ambassador and also a former governor and widely seen as a contender for the 2024 GOP nomination, right after on the 6th or the 7th, she came out and condemned it in pretty strong terms. But on Fox News a couple of days ago, she basically walked it all back and said enough is enough. And so I think it's pretty discouraging. You know, I mean, it was all done.
Jonathan, what do you feel is, if that walking back is indeed happening, what you perceive there, what do you think is going on?
What I think is going on there is that basically the polling hasn't moved all that much. You know, the polling hasn't been, there hasn't been a huge amount of polling on this, but it seems pretty clear that a large majority, of Republican voters back Trump over the Republican Party, over the institutional interests of the Republican Party. So in one poll I saw from a couple of days ago, Republican voters were divided into about thirds into whether or not they supported the Republican Party more, Donald Trump more, or neither or both. Those are about buckets of thirds. And what that means is that, you know, potential Republican office holders have to, you know, these are voters for them. So they can't alienate them.
Right. And Donna, the last minute or show of our hour, to you on this point.
I think what you'll see in the future is a 9/11 style commission that will study this issue of what happened and make a record of what happened and record the failings. So the 9/11 Commission was created by Congress through legislation, and it was a bipartisan panel of former elected officials that studied that issue. It took them a year or more, and it was a year after the event, I think, before that was created. Because there were obviously security failings here. There was obviously some wariness of the optics of having military there before this would even happen, especially given the events over the summer. And so I think you will see, you're already going to see some investigations within Congress, but I think you will probably see an effort, a push to get a larger investigation of what those security failings were at the Capitol.
Okay, thank you very much. Donna Hoffman, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Jonathan Haseed, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. To be continued, as always, on Politics Day. Thank you for your observation and your analysis. Jonathan and Donna, we appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ben.
And thanks, of course, to the input, email, and calling input from our listeners as well. Tomorrow on the program, what's it been like to work in an Iowa meatpacking plant during the many months of this pandemic? Tomorrow on the program, we'll be joined by IPR's Cassidy Arena. She'll help us trace the dangerous spread of COVID-19 in meatpacking communities here in the Midwest. We'll learn about the frustration of workers, their family members, and where things stand now. That tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.